this is Jack Leffler. Today on Encounters with Consciousness, we'll listen to different points of view expressed by friends of mine, whom I've interviewed over the years, and for whose perspectives I have great respect. Each of these folks has given a great deal of thought to the health of our planetary biotic community, and to the presence of the human species, our species, as part of this community of life. It is my hope that hearing these voices will contribute to a growing sense of mindfulness as to how we can better comport ourselves and reshape our cultural attitudes to better align ourselves within our greater biotic community. We'll begin with Daniel Kemmes, author and former mayor of Missoula, Montana.
Well, we've come to think of politics and political systems almost entirely in terms of people. We devise our systems entirely around people, essentially having ignored place or where it is that we live is kind of factored out of the political equation to a large extent. Or when it is factored in, it's factored in an arbitrary way that I think somehow gets in the way of a workable politics. Now, we had a great warning of this from John Wesley Powell, who said, if you're going to inhabit this arid landscape of the West, you're going to have to do it on the land's own terms. And that means you ought to create your political subdivisions according to the way the water flows and the way the landscape organizes itself. If you try to create them in other ways, you're going to get into a lot of trouble. We're finally, 100 years later, realizing that. And I think on a lot of different levels, we're now realizing that somehow, in order to do well politically, in order to do well as a species, that we have to pay attention to where we are. We have to let the landscape determine our communities and recognize that those communities are real living things on the landscape, and that politics is not a matter of figuring out what each individual wants and then adding that up, but figuring out what this living body on the landscape wants and needs and how it can best prosper. That's a form of thinking that is just very alien to us, but I think now it's become crucial to learn it.
Next, we'll hear from Danny Lopez, a Tohono O'odham elder.
The land was always considered to be something special. They even used to say that the land was a person. Plants were respected because certain plants give us medicine. As I sit here, I'm looking at all the creosote in front of me because creosote is one of the plants that we call a medicinal plants. The mesquite, certain areas we get mesquites to build our fences, our ramadas, and the old homes that we used to build. The earth gives us, helps us, so we respect the earth. And also certain plants gave us food, like the saguaro. We eat the saguaro fruit, the choya buds, prickly pear, the wild spinach, those little buds that they're called papago lily. Even off the mesquite tree, we get mesquite bean, the sap, and other things too that help us in other ways. Like there's a certain part of the mesquite that we use to seal our gourd rattles. It was like a glue. And even off the creosote, there's this little thing that forms on there. And even that was heated up and used as a glue. So the plants help us. And so we have a lot of respect for certain plants. We say the saguaro is a person. We were always told that if we don't eat the choya buds, you know, as children, that eat it will cause a flood, you know. When you first eat something of the season, maybe the prickly pear fruit, before you eat the first fruit, you talk to it, you pray to it. Same thing, especially the saguaro fruit. We always do that. We take a little of the saguaro fruit and we place it over our heart and we pray. My elderly mother used to tell us that you have to be industrious, because industriousness, to be a good worker, was something valuable in the old culture. Nobody liked a lazy person. Because to be a worker, you were useful to your community, to your family, and to yourself. to be an early riser, because that was a very important value in the old culture, to get up early and to get things done and not to sleep late. Especially during the summertime out here in the desert, got up early and while it was still cool and deep, many of your chores before it got too hot, and then you could rest later on. And you ask for good health, because a long time ago, people lived a healthy life. Their diet was healthy, eating off the land. The animals that we hunted, the rabbit, the pack rat, the mule deer, javelina, and other animals that helped us survive. We simply just didn't go and kill an animal. We killed for our survival. And some people used to say that when you killed the deer, you spoke to the deer spirit to tell why you made the kill, so that we as people can survive.
Lillian Hill is a young Hopi woman who is a founder of the Black Mesa Water Coalition and is director of Hopi Tutska Permaculture.
A lot of the ways that we refer to the earth and to those animals and plants and to the clouds and rains that come is through a lot of the ceremonies and songs that we're exposed to when we're really young. And so within these songs, songs are about a lot of things. They're about pollination, about different types of rains that come. So we learn to recognize and also to know different types of weather patterns. There's all types of rain that come, and there's a lot of different words for them. Like Sivuvuta is the rain that comes like kind of gently down, and yoyoki is rain that just, you know, continually comes. And the ways that you describe those things, it comes with a way of experiencing it also. It's just like, well, yesterday it rained like this, and so in your mind you can recognize the experience of seeing rain falling that way and actually smelling how it smells when it rains like that. All of those things, those recognitions come with how we recognize different types of rains and also with the land, the different seasons. Every moon that comes has its own name and has its own activities. We do these different things during these different moons. There's a name for a moon that's called Hakitan Muya, and that means the waiting moon. After the men have planted the seeds and we're waiting for those things, and there's different activities that we have, but we know by these different names of the moons, what needs to be done. We learn those at a very young age, and so we learn how to associate those types of ways of describing things in our language. Those are the things that we use to kind of help to guide our activities, what we're going to do during those times.
Vernon Masayasva is a Hopi elder. He's a former chairman of the Hopi Tribal Council and is director of the Black Mesa Trust.
There's a point east of the Big Colorado, on the banks of Little Colorado River, a very sacred site we call Sipapuni, which is our emergence. It's our umbilical cord that connects us to our motherland. And we came up to the top. The elders apparently figured this is where we're going to stay. Those days, people were different, and they had a very close connection with the Creator. They discovered that a person was already living there because they found foot tracks. They finally found a man, Masa, working his field. And they approached Masa. Is this your land? No, it's not my land, but I take care of it. Then the question, can we stay here with you? And Masa said, that's not up to me. That's up to you people. And he told them to look around. What do you see? It's barren land, so it's a hard place to settle. It's poor and yet it's rich. So if you decide to stay, that would be your decision. So they finally agreed that they would stay. Masa says, well, then you have to help me steward this land. And they agreed to a covenant. So we decided that we would live with Masa, help steward the land, live according to his law.
Gary Paul Nabhan is the author of over 30 books, is the founder of Native Seed Search, and is an active agricultural ecologist.
The most exciting thing happening in the West, from my perspective, is the collaborative conservation movement, where people of diverse backgrounds are saying, we share this watershed in common, we share this food shed in common, we share this larger food production system, from the highlands where the sheep pasture in the summer down to the lowland irrigated pastures in valleys where they can be in the winter. And that means people collaborating beyond the narrow interests of individual private land owners to allow whole systems to function cohesively across boundaries. And to some extent, I think what we'll see in the future is what some people are calling now landscape labeling, or branding of foods from a watershed or food shed that are grown sustainably along with the fiber from there, the timber from there, and that watersheds where communities come together to embrace the same stewardship principles will get a premium for their products, whether it's beef or vegetables or timber or fuel wood, because urban consumers will be willing to invest more in that land stewardship and the ecosystem services from that landscape, rather than just paying for the product like beef or cucumbers or firewood alone. And so what I see is that over the last 20 years, we've seen incredible innovation in how people farm and ranch, and that individual families have demonstrated means of sustainability in different habitats all over the West. And yet many of their neighbors have not had the capital, knowledge, skills, interest, or public support to move in that same direction. So many of the key innovators, I think back to Peter Van Dresser in your area, that were talking about these issues 30 years ago, have not seen their neighbors embrace these same practices. Why? Because there's been no economic incentive to get over the hurdles to restore land that's been badly damaged. And that only by having a sense of the commons, that the wealthier landowners and the poorer landowners with the more damaged land pool their resources to heal the weak links, to strengthen the weak links in their wildlife corridor or in their food chain, can we bring the whole system up to the quality and integrity of stewardship that we see from Valair Austin or from Sid Goodlow or from Dan Imhoff or from Dennis Maroney or these other great innovators that we see in the West right now. That to some extent, as long as we say, I'm only concerned about the stewardship on my piece of private property, the whole health of the watershed will still be imperiled. When we embrace returning the entire watershed to its ecological health and mobilize financial as well as knowledge resources to do that, then there will be lasting benefits from the kind of innovations that we've seen emerge over the last 20 years.
Edward Abbey was a renowned American author and is regarded by many as the godfather of the radical environmental movement.
By virtue of being alive, we deserve to be respected as individuals. And I'm saying that that respect for the value of each human being should be extended to each living thing on the planet. Our fellow creatures, beginning with our pet dogs and cats and horses, humans find it easy to love them, and we should learn to love the wild animals, the mountain lions and the rattlesnakes and the coyotes, and developing that way to extend our ability to love to plant life. I think a tree, a shrub, deserves respect and sympathy as a living thing. And not even go beyond that, to the rocks, to the air, and to the water, because it's all part of the whole.
Melissa Savage is a biogeographer now emerita at UCLA and is the director of the Four Corners Institute.
Where the commons works is where people are of a mind about the fate of the environment. And only in the past few years have certain things been talked about broadly. For example, in North America, things like ecosystem services. The recognition, the broad consensus that, oh, watersheds provide something for all of us, that we can't just make private hay out of them because we need them. We need them to be intact. And, you know, I'm so impressed with the shift in consensus about what it means to have. I think global climate change has really pushed this into a new gestalt, a new way of thinking about where we are, who we are. Yeah. And of course, the downside of commons is the overuse. And so you have to have an agreement, and this is difficult to get. We have an extremely diverse society, and we have a somewhat polarized society, as we all know, politically speaking. And so, you know, the task is really to somehow have everyone recognize what's at stake in a commons. The air, the water. The water, the fact that global climate change is going to completely change precipitation patterns. Talk about natural processes, you know. Global climate change is just a natural process. I mean, it's actually happened many times in Earth's history. And it's happening now, but it's our doing. And of course, we have all these institutions, all these common institutions in place based on what's been going on for hundreds of years. We count on it raining X amount for our agriculture. And if that doesn't start to create a better consensus about what the commons is, obviously not North America, not the Southwest, not the region, the globe. The globe is a bioregion. What people do in one place has an incredibly strong teleconnection to other places.
Peter Warshall was an editor for the Whole Earth Catalog, environmental activist, and a great visionary.
Watersheds are a great way of looking at things, and of course, the problem is that water is much more complicated than a watershed. And I remember my eureka moment was in the Armagosa Basin. The Armagosa is a part of Death Valley, and when you go down the Armagosa Basin, the river actually turns around and goes into Death Valley. But if you look at the groundwater, it goes under the mountains and comes back to the headwaters. And I began to realize, okay, the invisible here is always groundwater. And it's really one of the most powerful ways that human communities, especially now with pumps, have arranged their lives for human settlement. And so that complicates watershed thinking, because watershed thinking is the surface thinking. It's how runoff on the surface goes, but it doesn't take care of the invisible. And the most sacred places on the planet, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, have been where the invisible emerges, which is springs. There was the place where animals came together for drinking, where medicinal herbs grew best, especially mint, being a water lover, where women gathered both to wash and prepare food. The spring, where the invisible becomes visible in water, is equally important to the watershed itself. And so that's how I would go looking for the commons. I would start at the spring and see where that emergence point is. And that's why so many of the stories are emergent points, you know, in the Hopi stories, you emerge out of the earth. It's a little confusing why people would come from underground. Well, I think it's because life-giving water comes from underground at springs.
Sarah Natani is a celebrated Navajo weaver who has spent her long life herding her sheep in the Chuska Mountains south of the San Juan River.
Well, my uncle, his name was Ben Bita, and then he used to have a farm over there. There was a big ditch there, and then I guess they used to pump the water through there, and it used to come down, and then we used to get the bucket of water there and drink water from it, and none of us ever got sick from that, drinking that San Juan River. And I know that water is very precious to everybody, not only to Navajos or white men or anybody. The Great Spirit have put the water there for us to all share it, to use it. Not one person takes over the whole water.
Herman Atin is an Atali, or medicine man, who has spent his life at Navajo Mountain.
Everything here between the earth, the sun, the moon, it's all related. It's all related to ceremonies, or it's all in the creation stories. Before humans, before we were made, there were only deities, spirits that were in this here world. They're part of being healthy for us. They're part of nature that we have to use, that we have to acknowledge to taking care of ourselves, our family, our relatives, and maybe for our society. It's all part of it. The sun, the earth, the moon, and everything. In our culture, we have the benefit of having it in our creation stories, and we can relate back to it to help us be better people, to help us acquire the knowledge that is related to it, to function and have respect for ourselves and everything else.
Lawrence Taylor is the president and CEO of Native Public Media and is one of the founders of the Hopi Education Endowment Fund.
It's hard to divorce yourself from those thoughts of a living world when you're a Hopi person. To think of things as having an end to them, as being lifeless, is probably easier to comprehend if you were just dealing with scientific experimentation. But when you start thinking about what does it all mean, what's the purpose of life, is there life hereafter, all those great philosophical questions that mankind often ask themselves. From the Hopi perspective, it's a living world. It always has been. And it just continues. It's a continuum. And that's where the connections are made.
Mina Suenzo was born at the Santa Clara Pueblo on the banks of the Rio Grande in northern New Mexico. She is truly one of the wisest people I've ever met.
The old ancestral people moved through this region for thousands of years. And the intimacy that they developed with the land, I think is what has kept them going for so long in such a place. And even today, I think we've forgotten that has helped our people survive for so long, is that intimacy that we had with the land, with the place, with the rocks, the mountains. Part of that intimacy, of course, was, especially in this region, is to know where the water areas are. The water is seen as being absolutely important for life. Without it, creation doesn't happen. You know, it's the semen of the Father that keeps creation going. But the snaking water through this region, the Rio Grande, the lakes, and of course throughout all of Pueblo mythology, the lakes are very important. All water places are extremely important, because that's without water we don't survive here. And it's so sparse that they do have to become very special places. But there are also those places at which the energy of the world is very strong, because there are also openings, places to go to the underworlds, or, you know, to other levels of existence. There are openings also into the other world. The Rio Grande is a place that is also frightening to the Pueblo people. It's frightening because it comes with incredible power. It's the power. And that's why I think that we talk about the water, wind, breath, because the power of all of creation is there. And it can be in the wind, and it is and certainly in the water, especially in that strong flowing water that we know it. You know, and the word in Tewa for Rio Grande is Osonge, the large water place.
I recorded Toni Singer reading her poem in her home in the Santa Clara Pueblo when she was 12 years old.
My name sits on a soft, smooth lake. My voice sounds like gentle rain falling from the sky, hitting me like hard, strong lightning. When the cold wind comes, I flow from place to place. My name is soft, soft like a big flat quilt. A few winter days pass. Singing birds are looking for juicy worms. Blooming flowers grow. Life comes back into me. Flowers grow and trees fall on me. I am Queen Povi. I am Lake Flower. If you look into me, you'll see a beautiful person. You'll see yourself.
Alan Pinkham is an elder and a member of the Nez Perce tribe. Many of his people live in the watershed of the Clearwater River.
If you relate your body parts to individual species that have been eradicated from this North American continent, if you relate the peregrine falcon to your little finger, and the buffalo to another finger, or maybe the sockeye salmon up to your elbow, when would you stop sacrificing your body parts to save a species? If you relate your body to your Mother Earth and the environment, that's another way of thinking. But if you do that, you'll start to understand the way Indians feel about Mother Earth. Let's not sacrifice one species for another. Let's restore the habitat. Let's restore the species. Because if you relate that to body parts, when are you going to say no? No more extraction and utilization to extinction of species.
I believe that cultural diversity and biological and geophysical diversity are deeply interlinked. Homeland greatly shapes perspective. Remaining native, or even becoming native to place, is crucial for developing a balanced perspective. Encounters with Consciousness is a production of The Lore of the Land and is funded by a grant from the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. This is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.